Welcome to Imagined Tomorrow. This is a podcast where we imagine futures for India through the lens of science and technology. In every episode, we will explore one hypothetical future scenario for India, and we will talk to various experts and see how the journey to that future might play out, keeping Indian realities in mind. I am your host, Shreya Dasgupta. In this episode, we are imagining a future where some cities in India expand underground. Imagine this. The population in our cities is at an all-time high. 500 million people already live there and more people want to come in. Land is incredibly scarce. The cities have no space to grow outwards. If they do, it'll come at an extraordinary expense of our already severely depleted agricultural farms and slivers of forests. So our city administrators have taken a call. Instead of growing horizontally, the cities will grow downwards, below the land the cities already have. This will not just solve our land issues, but also protect us from all the impending disasters on the surface, be it climate change related or war. This hypothetical future raises many possibilities. So I'll try and answer three questions. Can Indian cities technically expand underground? If it's possible, what would we move below our land surface? And would people even want to live or work there?
Air Villas offers you luxurious residences in soon-to-be Delhi's tallest building. High-end apartments and penthouses with saunas, jacuzzis and infinity pools. Views of the Qutub Minar and the Central Vista. And not just that, Air Villas is India's first project with underground nuclear bunkers. Because better safe than sorry. Starting at 6 crore only.
This was not a sponsored ad, only a fictitious one. But there is an actual project like this in Delhi. An ultra-luxurious apartment complex called Leela Sky Villas that's offering flats starting from 6 crore rupees or 800,000 US dollars. It claims to be building underground nuclear bunkers for its ultra-rich residents. Because why not be ready for a nuclear war? After all, both India and Pakistan are nuclear powers and both have exchanged their fair share of threats with each other. And if there is an inclination of a war, and you have underground bunkers ready, you could escape, spend several months there, and maybe live to tell the story. Although I wonder if these bunkers will have several months' worth of frozen parathas, or if the wealthy residents will want fresh food every meal. Underground bunkers are not unusual. During the Cold War, many such fallout shelters were built across the world.
One very good example is from China.
This is Dr. R.K. Goyal, an expert in tunnel and underground space design and a former professor at the Central Institute of Mining and Fuel Research in Dhanbad.
In the 1960s and 70s, because of the threat of nuclear war, the Chinese government ordered the construction of a mammoth fallout shelter beneath their capital of Beijing.
This fallout shelter under Beijing, called Dixia Cheng, was not one room or a few bunkers. It was a massive city, built by more than 300,000 local people, including children, and some of it was dug by hand, it seems.
And this hand-dug site was supposedly capable of safeguarding around 1 million people for up to 4 months. So you can imagine that how much storage facility they might be having for, you know, for food and other purposes.
This underground city even had schools, restaurants, rooms to grow mushrooms, barber shops, and recreational centers. Because you have to entertain people who are stuck in a new place, who knows for how long. It never came to be used for the purpose it was built for, but Dixia Cheng remains till date as a reminder of our paranoia of wars. The Indian government has also been building thousands of underground bunkers in Jammu province at the line of control. These are meant to give the local residents a refuge from the regular shell attacks they face there. This kind of temporary underground living is not a modern innovation though.
First example can be found from Kashmir way back 3000 BC. This was, you know, brought to notice by Archaeological Survey of India during their excavation in 1960.
This site called Burza Home is located in Srinagar district of Kashmir. Archaeologists found that the people there, at one point, lived in subterranean homes or pits that they dug into the soil, most likely to protect themselves from the severe winter outside. Similarly, you'll find many examples of underground tunnels, rooms, halls, places of worship built in different parts of India, from Ellora caves in Maharashtra to temples in Hampi and forts in Rajasthan.
In the medieval era, we have forts where there were underground pathways, basement halls for storage, meeting halls, summer retreats, and water tunnels.
If we look internationally, there were actually entire underground cities, like in Turkey. Underneath a town called Derinkuyu, people in the 7th to 8th century BCE built a massive system of caverns that go 60 to 85 meters beneath the surface. This is more than 20 stories of a modern high-rise building, only underground. Historians say this underground city could accommodate some 20,000 people. It had wineries, cellars, passages, tunnels, and around 15,000 ventilation ducts to provide fresh air. People apparently used this underground complex mainly to escape from attacks from various armies on the surface. Today, one place I know of where people willingly live underground is in this place called Cooper Pedy in Australia. Cooper like Uber and Pedy like ready. Cooper Pedy is a small town located in a very, very hot desert, a region where indigenous people have lived for a long time. Europeans discovered they could mine opal gems in that area and make a fortune, and so many of them settled there, forming the town of Cooper Pedy. Since the outside temperatures can get very hot, many residents have created beautiful underground homes, complete with lounges, bedrooms, kitchens, and bathrooms.
That is a very unique location. I mean, obviously, there it's very, very hot, and it's a good idea to keep out of the heat as much as possible. Definitely saves on your air conditioning bill.
This is Dr. Adam Charles Roberts, a researcher in Singapore who studies the psychological and social effects of working in different spaces, including the underground. I got in touch with him because Singapore is one of our close neighbors with an elaborate underground expansion plan for its future. And like he says, living underground could be a good idea when it's very hot outside.
Because in general, an underground space will have a consistent temperature. And the consistent temperature will be approximately the average of the year's temperature.
If the average of the year's temperature is a cool, comfortable one, you won't need air conditioning or heating, which could mean lots of savings on electricity bills, something we would want for a sustainable future. The Cooper Pedy dugout homes, for example, usually don't need air conditioning during summers, while the surface buildings do. But for many cities, the annual average temperature won't be comfortable, and so being underground won't help from an energy-saving perspective. Like in Singapore.
Singapore actually has a problem there where the natural climate of an underground space isn't that comfortable because the average of a Singapore climate is still hot. Like we're a tropical city, it's always hot. The difference between our summer and our winter is a few degrees. So really you're not saving anything on like a temperature way. And I think if we put it in an Indian context, it would very much depend on the city in India that you apply it to. Because some cities are very hot year-round and some have a much more variable temperature.
Think about the variation in temperature you see in your city. Also, maybe think about how you feel your city's climate has been changing over the past few years. Hotter days, more intense cyclones, erratic weather, what do you see? So would having underground living areas then make sense for a hypothetical future?
So personally, I don't believe living underground is a viable option at the moment. Who knows in the future with climate change, especially in a place like Cooper Pedy, where it is very, very hot. I can understand the reasoning for building underground there. And potentially there are other locations in the world where it may be a good idea.
I asked Dr. Roberts if he would ever want to live underground.
For me personally, I would prefer to have a nice view. And if you can free up the surface land, you can make it nicer for housing.
After seeing some of the Cooper Pedy homes on YouTube, I don't mind the idea of living underground, as long as I have access to the surface. In fact, fiction writers have imagined entire underground cities, like the children's book, The City of Ember. But in many of these books, people move underground to live, usually to escape something on the surface, such as a climate or a war apocalypse. But maybe it doesn't have to be utter dystopia that drives us underground. Maybe, as Dr. Roberts says, we can use the underground to create better living spaces on the surface. So keeping this aim in mind, what can Indian cities move underground? And what would it take to achieve that?
So when I go underground, I feel myself more comfortable.
As a rock mechanics and geology expert, Dr. Goel has consulted on more than 60 underground projects, like facilities for hydroelectric power plants and tunnels for railway tracks and roads up in the Himalayas. He's also advocated strongly for utilizing underground spaces, not just in the mountains or the outskirts of our urban centers, but also within our congested metropolitan cities.
And I always say that it's a remarkable resource that is largely underdeveloped, but available worldwide. So I think the time is ripe for exploring the possibilities of developing underground space for civic utilities in megacities.
Our cities already have some things underground, like sewage and water pipelines or fiber optic cables. Other utilities are on their way to being buried. States like Maharashtra have been moving their power cables underground. The advantages of doing this could be fewer power cuts during heavy rains, lower power theft, and also fewer electrocutions of both humans and non-humans. One prominent move towards using the underground space in our cities is the underground metro, which ferries people from one part of the city to another under homes, parks, offices, and malls. When the first underground stretch of metro in India opened in Kolkata in 1984, it was amidst a lot of questions and chaos. But as writer Indraneel Banerjee wrote in India Today that year, when the sleek glass and metro train finally arrived, to most Calcuttans, it looked like a science fiction fantasy.
So for that reason, I always, you know, compliment the Kolkata people, the government of Kolkata, because when we had this facility, people have supported. Now you see, all these cities, now they are coming, maybe surface, maybe underground, maybe surface, partly underground, partly surface. But now it has picked up.
Or consider shops. If you're familiar with Delhi, you might know Palika Bazaar. This is a huge, completely underground shopping complex built in 1979, where you can find cheap electronic goods and clothes and tattoo parlors. Although it's possibly more well known for selling counterfeit products.
Now, if we look into the Palika Bazaar, this is out of sight, right? We cannot see on the surface that Palika Bazaar is there. So this summarizes the issue. The out of sight is out of mind.
When you stand on the side of a road, do you think about all the water and sewage pipes and gas pipelines that might be underneath your feet? Do you wish they were on the surface instead? Probably not. Similarly, Dr. Goel says there are lots of other things that we could shift underground and not miss on the surface at all, freeing up valuable surface land for our hypothetical future. But we'll need to think creatively.
If I give here the example, a government is planning to develop about 100 smart cities.
Under the Smart City Mission, the government aims to make these cities more livable, environmentally sustainable, and economically viable through quote-unquote smart solutions.
And if you look into their document, they have mentioned that smartness in a city means smart eco-friendly design, smart utilities, smart housing, smart mobility, smart technology, greater employment opportunities, etc. But what I think that in this smartness of a city, we can have some facilities underground, like physical infrastructure, water supply system, sewerage system, sanitation facilities, solid waste management systems, drainage system that can be planned underground.
Many cities have already done that or are in the process. For example, Stockholm in Sweden has one of the world's largest underground wastewater treatment plants. It was built in a massive rock way back in the 1930s, then expanded over the decades. And keeping it underground allows the city to utilize its surface for greenery, housing, and other uses. Similarly, Hong Kong is also working on relocating one of its major sewage treatment works to the underground. This move, the government says, will free up an area of about 69 acres for more housing and other community developments. China already has several of these underground waste treatment plants, and they have plans of more.
Similarly, facilities for industry, for business offices, and for recreation, that these can be placed underground.
The town of Jovik in Norway, for example, built an ice hockey rink and other sports facilities underground for the 1994 Olympic Winter Games. they had a choice between an underground arena and an ordinary outdoor one. But in the end, they decided to make use of their bedrock and go below the ground. That way, they would remain within the downtown area, which would mean low travel costs, and they would not have to touch the valuable surface property or alter the town's cityscape.
And we can also plan like warehouses. We can go for the storages for food. We can go for the cold storages. We can go for R&D centers. Singapore, they started working for underground science city.
Like I mentioned earlier, Singapore has an elaborate underground expansion plan because it has limited space to grow horizontally. And this includes a large science city that will hold offices and laboratory space for IT, biotech and life science research, all underground. So which Indian cities could we create these kinds of facilities in? Dr. Goel says there are lots of possibilities because to create underground spaces, it helps to have hard rocks that you can excavate into. Rocks that have fewer fractures or weak points and are capable of supporting heavy loads. And many Indian cities have these kinds of rocks under them.
Like in Delhi also, we have quartzite. It's a good rock for underground construction. In south, down south, where peninsular area, we have very good rocks. Granites is there. We have in Bundelkhand area, we have very good sandstone there.
These granites, quartzites, Bundelkhand sandstones, or basalts of the Deccan Plateau that form the bedrock of many of our cities are ancient. At least hundreds to thousands of millions of years old. Quietly watching species after species, one human civilization after another, pass them by. And they are not hard to spot. If you are in Bangalore, for example, you can see these granites popping out throughout the city, in Lal Bagh or on the way to the airport. Now, this stress on the choice of rocks is because the harder the rock, the less costly it is to tunnel into, because they don't need as much reinforcement. It's not like you can't create underground spaces in softer rocks. The Indo-Gangetic Plains, for example, where Kolkata lies, has soft rocks and soil. So any construction there would need to be strengthened by steel or cement or something else, which would make it not impossible, but more expensive to build underground spaces in.
There is one index to measure the quality of the rock mass, which is called GSI, Geological Strength Index. So this ranges from 0 to 100. If it is 0, that means it is not rock, it is more towards soil. So if you compare the cost varies with GSI. As GSI increases, cost reduces. Similarly, as the size of the tunnel increases, cost increases. Now, if you look into the Kolkata Metro, first phase, that was all excavated through the soil. And soil means it's a very costly affair. But if you look into the Bangalore area, where the granite is there, it will be comparatively less costly. And with time, you see, when the technology comes, when it becomes more popular, cost will become less.
The cost will also depend on how big the underground space is and what it will be used for. Whether an office or a storage facility, which will then determine what kind of lighting or ventilation it will need. The cost will also depend on things like whether we pay our workers who are building these underground spaces a fair wage. But technically, it is possible for our cities to expand underground for many different purposes that go beyond just cables and pipelines. The geology of many Indian cities supports it, so does our technical expertise. But how do we go about figuring out where to put these underground spaces? Dr. Goel says that we need not only rock mechanics and geology experts like him who can tell us the cost of excavating, supporting the structures and keeping them safe, but also people with a deep understanding of urban planning. Experts who can guide us on what we can build where. So let's hear from one.
So the first thing which comes to our mind, you know, like we have a base map of a city, we know without a map, we cannot plan. Rather, any planner, we cannot think without maps.
This is Dr. Sanjukta Bhaduri, a professor of urban planning in the School of Planning and Architecture in New Delhi.
Similarly, we need to map the underground space which is there below our city.
Because unless we map, we will not know where the existing developments are. Today, below the surface, you'll find foundations of buildings, basements of apartments and homes, parking lots of malls, underground metro lines and stations, sewer lines and various utilities, and storage areas that might be today lying defunct. There could be places we don't even remember or know of.
So that means the depths are varied. So that today we have to know now where we can develop, where we cannot develop. Anywhere and everywhere we cannot develop.
Singapore, for example, did this mapping exercise and released its draft underground master plan in 2019, detailing where all the existing facilities and utilities are and where all the future facilities like bus or rail networks, car parks, storage and logistics utilities and other things will be located and at what depths, some shallow, some deep. This map also visualizes the far future. What else can come up in the unutilized spaces after the initial phases of development? In India too, cities use master plans to visualize the development off the surface, although not all cities have them.
We have about 8,000 cities and towns, and about 20% of the cities and towns have master plan. Others do not have master plan. So now the national focus or agenda is to have more and more master plans, because master plans basically is a legal document which guides the development.
Just for the surface, creating these master plans is a tedious process. It can take many, many years. And even then, they are often imperfect. Still, master plans give us a way to visualize and control the future development of our cities. And for the underground, a well-thought-out master plan would probably be non-negotiable. Because working without any plan at all can create a big fat mess, as we often see on the surface.
The ramifications are that there are scattered development, there are unplanned development. Anywhere and everywhere you will have development. One will not bother about what resources are there, whether it is reclaiming a wetland and happening, or it is going into the coastal regulation zone. One would not know it.
Now, imagine such haphazard planning and development underground. What would the ramifications be? Damaged building foundations, dug up roads and land for the next 50 years?
So when you talk of a master plan, underground master plan cannot be a two-dimensional concept.
Instead, Dr. Bhaduri says an underground master plan has to be thought of from a three-dimensional perspective. Planning not just horizontally, where you look at what already exists and work around it, but also vertically, both in terms of different depths below the surface and also linking what is happening underground with what is happening above the surface.
Because underground, if you're cutting across any water supply line, it will become problematic for the entire settlement on the surface. That means if whatever you're doing underground, if there are conflicts somewhere, we disturb whatever is there, suppose storage or oil storage or whatever we disturb. So that is bound to impact the surface. So that means there is a relationship of the above the ground to the under the ground.
This conflict happened in Kolkata in 2019. During the tunneling work for a stretch of underground metro that was supposed to pass through a very crowded part of the city, the tunnel boring machine hit an unanticipated aquifer. This is a layer of sand and silt that was holding a lot of water. The ground around subsided, which in turn caused some buildings to collapse and many others to develop cracks. Authorities had to shift more than 400 people living there to hotels and guest houses nearby. There have been many such incidents across the world. Now, what if you hit a gas pipeline while tunneling for an underground shopping complex? Or what if the facility you build disrupts the groundwater underneath?
Because most of the cities today are also dependent on groundwater. But if suppose groundwater also gets disturbed because of the development underground, then in that case, the city will not sustain.
So there's a lot to first figure out, not just the plan's economic cost or technical feasibility, but also possible environmental and social impacts. The master plan also needs one crucial bit of information. Who owns the right to use the underground space?
Suppose I have a plot, or you have a plot, or anybody else has a plot, or a colony level, then tell how much depth is our jurisdiction, or is our possession, or is our ownership. Below that, what happens? So this sort of considerations have to be looked at.
Now, on the surface, the extents of your land boundaries have a legal basis. It is this land ownership that development authorities use to acquire land when planning city expansions. Although with land being scarce, acquiring land is getting harder to do. But Dr. Bhaduri says that we don't have any underground space utilization policy at the national level. Helsinki in Finland, for example, utilizes its underground extensively, and its legal underground master plan has detailed mapping of all the underground spaces at various depths reserved for future public and private facilities. Singapore also came up with legal amendments in 2015 that define the ownership of underground space. Surface landowners can own up to 30 meters of space under their properties, Anything below that belongs to the government. We will not be going down the legal side of this story because that's a very deep rabbit hole, but I'll say this. Clear guidelines can tell us if, say, only the state or city municipality can develop the underground space, or if private individuals or property developers can too. What if I want to buy a section of the city's bedrock to build an underground home for the future, my summer retreat, or maybe a nuclear bunker? Can different people own different sections of the underground space, and maybe we could become underground neighbors?
Like heights, every floor can have a different owner. But below the ground, what would be the ownership? So that, like, one needs to sort of find out. Legalization aspect, if it's not addressed, then it is very difficult to have a development or to have a master plan.
At the end of it, though, having a perfect legal framework and a detailed mapping of a city's underground will be pretty useless if different agencies continue to work separately without talking to each other as they do today.
If you see, when we plan for any city, many a time, every sector is working on its own. You know, every sector is doing good work, you know, but there is no cross-cutting from one sector to another sector. And that is why you see that roads are dug up so many times. So that means if we do not sort of have a coordinated thought process, we will not be able to effectively utilize the space below. Then in that case, the purpose for which we were going underground will be defeated. If we generate more problems by going underground, then why we should go underground? We anyway have enough problems overground.
But let's imagine for a moment that some cities are determined to come up with their underground master plans. So whatever facilities we plan to move below the surface, whether it's storage or offices or shopping complexes, there will be people working in these spaces. The question then is, would people want to work there? I'm going to the basement of a housing society in North Bangalore. It has about 200 flats, and the property manager's team works out of a three-room office in the basement.
It's peaceful now.
Peaceful.
This is Saraswati. She's been working in this basement office for over 5 years. I ask her not to call me ma'am, but she still does. Maybe that's the way she's used to greeting the residents who live there.
Only thing is STP, that's it. But otherwise it's peaceful, not an issue.
STP is the sewage treatment plant that the complex has installed in the basement. While Saraswati does not mind the office, in fact, she likes the silence, the smell from the STP when it's not functioning perfectly bothers her.
In case any air blower is off, that's when smell is spreading, that's it.
Yeah, like she said, the STP smell issue is there. And mobile networks, we are having issues.
This is Chintan, who works in the same office. He adds that mobile phone network can be patchy in the basement. And so Saraswati and he have to go to the surface sometimes to take personal calls. Unlike Saraswati, Chintan is relatively new to this basement office. Previously, he worked out of a place that was located on the second floor of a building.
It is always bright there. There is proper illumination and breeze, air. Here, it is kind of, you tend to feel hot because there is no air circulation.
I look around and yes, the office is dark white and fairly spacious with tall ceilings. But there's a stillness here.
Say a proper ventilation and exhaust and a fresh air supply would actually facilitate it.
Dr. Adam Charles Roberts, from whom we heard earlier, has in fact surveyed people in cities across the world trying to find out what concerns they have about working underground. And his team has found something similar.
But interestingly, for every city that we asked, and we asked in Singapore, in Shanghai, in London, and in Montreal, all of these people said that the most important factor for working in an underground space was air quality. If the air quality was good, then they would be more happy.
This was surprising, he says, because the team had expected that it would be the lack of windows that would be the top concern. Not being able to see the outside world and miss the view.
Because you can't put windows in underground spaces no matter what you try. I mean, you can put in skylights and you can put in maybe a virtual window, like a video screen that plays something outside. But actually, air quality was the most important thing.
As COVID-19 has taught us, ventilation should be a concern everywhere, whether you are on the 16th floor of a high-rise building or at the ground-level lobby of an office. But underground, as Dr. Roberts says, developers perhaps need to give it some extra thought.
Underground may be more important because it's more difficult, I think, to bring good fresh air into an underground space just because there's a greater distance to go. So the AC needs to be filtered for pollutants, needs to be a good temperature, the lighting needs to be good. It can't be too noisy, but at the same time, it can't be too quiet. In an above ground building, you can open the window if you don't like the air quality. So underground, you definitely need to have this mechanical ventilation to bring the air further. And in an above ground building, you can rely on sunlight. And underground, of course, it has to be artificial lighting.
Dr. Roberts thinks about spaces a lot. What makes people want to work in a given space? What helps them be happier, healthier, and more efficient? And what turns them away? And since building anything underground is a fairly costly proposition, these questions are worth finding answers to.
An above-ground factory, for example, the structure could be changed quite easily. The underground structure needs to be more carefully planned. You can't like knock it down once it's built. And you want to make sure that at the end of it, people are going to use it, they're going to want to be in that space.
Many older studies have found that just the idea of working underground can evoke quite a few negative emotions, from feelings of isolation to confinement to anxiety. They can also evoke associations with burial, hell, or the underworld. But in the hypothetical future we are imagining, the cities will basically take surface facilities and utilities and put them underground. So these are not going to be extreme environments like coal mines. Rather, they'll be modern workspaces, like the basement office where Saraswati and Chintan work. Visually, it looks like any other office.
So for me, then the interesting thing was, why do people find underground workspaces to be different and challenging? Could there be specific design elements that are related to underground spaces that could cause problems with productivity or health or mental well-being or something like that? And the reason for that is that, so no one wants to work in an office that makes them feel tired or stresses them out or makes them sick.
So they studied people working in modern underground city workspaces across the world. And a few important design elements did pop out. For example, in China, where they talked to people in cities like Beijing and Shanghai, both with substantial underground areas, they found that the underground workers did not mind being below the surface as long as they had two things. The first was the presence of indoor plants, which made them feel healthy.
But then if the plants in the office died, then they'd be really worried about the environment quality because suddenly, you know, if the plant dies, maybe I can die. Maybe it's not healthy. So for that, one thing that's like a big takeaway from that is if you're putting plants in an underground space, you need to make sure to keep them alive.
The workers were also fine with being in underground offices as long as they could occasionally go outside to the surface during the day.
So being able to go out on their breaks and not just have the break in their workplace, but go outside, maybe to a park nearby, get outside and see the sunshine.
It's also important to make the underground workspaces pleasant and welcoming to look at aesthetically. Because there's a tendency to associate being underground with being lesser in the social hierarchy. You might have seen this play out in your life, or in the IT crowd if you are a fan of the show.
Hello, IT. Have you tried turning it off and on again? Okay, well, the button on the side, is it glowing?
This British show is set in a building in central London. The IT support staff, not very respected, work out of a small, dingy, cramped basement office. The rest of the staff, including the CEO, have offices above ground with stunning downtown London views.
One of the things we would always say is try to make your underground workspace or structure as nice as you can, because there is a tendency for people to want to make the public-facing areas of building look really nice.
Just because it's an underground workplace, it doesn't have to be sad to look at.
But these are the areas that maybe if you put more money into them, your staff would be happier and healthier.
When you're underground, there's one more thing that becomes important, and that's the layout. Because when you are on the surface, you can look out of the window, see how various buildings are set around you, and then decide how you want to go from place A to place B.
Underground, you don't have that. You can see as far as the wall, and that's it. Which means that you have to plan better for the layout of the building and how to make sure that people understand exactly how to navigate and where things are.
Well, I've often spent several minutes looking at the map in underground metro stations in Delhi, not knowing which exit to take. I've also been confused in basement parking lots of malls. although I don't know if that has something to do with my personal lack of navigation skills. But as Dr. Roberts says, this layout issue can be seen in Montreal in Canada, which has the world's largest underground complex with corridors linking up metro stations, bus terminals, thousands of offices and homes and movie theaters and universities.
A lot of people use the space in the winter because it's protecting you from the snow. But one of the issues with it is that it's been developed over time and shopping malls sort of connect to each other with these underground tunnels that weren't in any sort of big master plan and were kind of just agreed partner to partner. So you end up with this layout which has no bearing on above ground structures, really. And so you get into situations where people, even though it's like snowing outside, people are likely to go up and look around outside to work out where exactly they are and where they think they need to go next, and then go back down underground and try to find their way around. So this is one of the problems that might come up.
But just imagine being in a city that is compact. Imagine a city where you can walk comfortably and freely just because all of the city's traffic has been diverted underground. Where you can live in homes on the surface, but you can also easily take an elevator, go underground and take public transit to go wherever you want to go.
And some people within Singapore can do that. You know, they live in a really expensive tower block in the center of the city, and they can take an underground connector straight to their workplace. So if we can do more multi-use developments like that, I think that could lead to a lot of savings, a lot of commuting time savings, and also reduce a lot of pollution because people aren't driving cars as much.
Now I'll go back to the question we started with. Can we live underground? If we could perfect our working environments underground, make them safe and welcoming, and if we could plan exceedingly well, would you willingly want to also go live underground? Dr. Bhaduri thinks not.
When we talk of residences, basically it's not people. Now, really would be people like to go underground without any connect with the surrounding, without fresh air, without walking to the next riverfront or to the lake or having a walk in the park or recreational area. Would it really be feasible unless you're compelled, unless some situations compel you?
But what if you wanted to make it big in a city like Mumbai, where rents are unreasonably high? What if you had underground rooms available in South Bombay or Marine Drive that were one-third the price of the flats above? Would you live there? In Beijing, for example, lots of young migrants come into the city seeking better lives and livelihoods. And many live in cramped underground rooms in the city centre. They are sometimes referred to as the rat tribe. It's not entirely legal, but it's way cheaper, and it helps the young folks get a foot into the door. So yes, compelling reasons could look different for each of us. It could be climate change for some, war for some, social motivations for some, or just survival. But I do think that for as long as possible, we will individually try and hold on to our lives on this beautiful planet. Looking at trees and birds, and specks of white clouds in stunning blue skies. Feeling the drops of rain. Feeling the hot sun on our skin. Watching the sun rise and bathe us in light. And then, several hours later, watch the darkness set in, prodding us to sleep. This episode was created and hosted by me, Shreya Dasgupta. The intro and outro music is by Abhijit Shailanath. The episode was co-edited by Abhishek Madan, who was also the voice of the fictitious ad you heard at the beginning of the episode. He also created one of the background music pieces. To read the transcript of this episode, head over to the website imaginedtomorrow.com. You can also write to me and send me ideas for futures or any feedback to imagined.tomorrow@gmail.com. If you liked the episode, do share it with your friends and family. If you would like to support us, you can do it by giving us a shout out on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, or you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to Imagine Tomorrow on whatever app you use to listen to the episodes. That's all for today. See you again soon.